good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 718 of Unwelcome Guests. The increasing shallowness of the deep state. I'm Robin Upton, and let me first explain the title. Here's me with no intelligence agency contacts, no inside knowledge, just taking a long hard look at material which is on the public record and drawing my own conclusions, noting an ever more clear gap between people's stated motives and actions and what is actually evident. Now, the greater this discrepancy, the more clear it is that these so-called political leaders are not actually interested in representing electorates, but are marching to the beat of a different drum, the more problematic for the deep state if that relies on secrecy. I've decided to make an episode with that as the title, just to try and be quite clear about this. Let's look at this in context. Is this just becoming clear to me because I've been spending ages studying it? Well, it should be. But I think this is part of what Brzezinski might refer to as a global political awakening, facilitated in large part by a technology which allows people to communicate, and through the World Wide Web especially, to send their attention to those they want to pay attention to, not to a limited choice dictated by the masters of the commercially controlled media. 20th century technology, newspapers, radio, television, the old mass media, was preset to listening to those who had the expensive machinery and controlled those systems. The newspaper presses, the broadcasting stations, 21st century technology. If you buy a laptop, yes, it might come with a bunch of junk installed, but it's pretty easy to slap Linux on it and use it, as I do, to send information as well as to receive information. Now, I was researching WikiSpooks last week. This Operation 40, the CIA hit squad fingered for a significant role in the JFK assassination, came across this chap, Edwin Wilson. I thought, well, let's find his Wikipedia page. What does the official narrative have to say about this chap? I've never heard of him. And, aha, more than just a bit player in the war on terrorism, as we shall find out. Just a pointer to how selective the commercial media and the official history of the US actually is. I'm going to be reading the following article by the late Mike Ruppert. He, in his From the Wilderness newsletter, wrote the following in the year 2000. Ed Wilson's Revenge. The biggest CIA scandal in history has its feet in the starting blocks in a Houston courthouse. The following is written after examining more than 900 pages of documents in 4 volumes filed since last September in Houston Federal Court by attorneys representing former CIA operative Edwin P. Wilson and the United States Department of Justice. As strange as it may seem, From the Wilderness assures you that there is a document on file or an on-the-record quote to support everything we now tell you. On February 2, 1983, the Houston trial of former CIA agent Edwin P. Wilson on federal charges that he had unlawfully sold explosives to Libya hung at a truly precarious moment. In chambers, the judge hearing the case had refused to allow a CIA witness using the pseudonym William Larson to testify using a false name. The CIA and prosecutors like aggressive Northern Virginia Assistant United States Attorney Ted Greenberg, relying on investigative materials produced under the direction of Washington, D.C., Assistant United States Attorneys Larry Barcella and Carol Bruce, were also concerned about limiting Wilson's ability to cross-examine Larson for security reasons. Larson's intended testimony would have included statements that, according to CIA records under Larson's care, Ed Wilson had not been a CIA employee or done any work for the agency since 1971. According to Barcella, who gave a detailed interview to From the Wilderness for this story, the judge's ruling raised serious security concerns for the Justice Department. The CIA records issue still needed to be addressed from another angle, and quickly. Wilson's defense had already made the case that the CIA had known and sanctioned the activities for which he was now on trial. That position needed to be countered in the rebuttal phase before the case went to the jury. Time was running out. Ed Wilson stood accused of shipping £42,000 of the plastic explosive C4 directly to Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 1977 and then hiring US experts, former US Army Green Berets, to teach Gaddafi's people how to make bombs shaped like lamps, ashtrays, and radios. Bombs were actually made, and foes of Gaddafi were actually murdered. This was the ongoing crime that had made Wilson and his still missing accomplice, former CIA employee Frank Turpil, the most infamous desperados in the world. C4, according to some experts, is the most powerful non-nuclear explosive made. 2 pounds in the right places can bring down a jumbo jet. Hence, £42,000 would be enough to bring down 21,000 jumbo jets. C4 is highly prized on the world's black markets and is much in demand. It's supposedly very tightly controlled where it is manufactured, in the US. At the time, it was shipped from Houston International Airport in 1977. The £42,000 of C4 represented almost the entire United States domestic supply. It had been collected for Wilson by one California explosives distributor who collected it from a number of manufacturers around the country. Surprisingly, no one had officially noticed. Wilson had, in earlier and subsequent deals, also sold a number of handguns to Gaddafi, and several had been used in the assassinations of Libyan dissidents in a number of countries, including the United States. It was these and other firearms violations by Wilson, including a scheme to ship more than 1,000 M16 rifles to Gaddafi, that had put the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and Larry Barcella on Wilson's trail back in late 1977. That investigation, which resulted in a 1982 Virginia conviction, led to the discovery of the C4 shipment to Gaddafi. By January of 1983, Barcella and a team of dedicated BATF agents had been on Ed Wilson's trail for 5 long years. Barcella, in Houston as an observer and advisor, had been twiddling his thumbs most of the time, but he did testify as a witness. He was, by virtue of his role as the originator of the cases, the institutional memory of the DOJ. Ted Greenberg had, from the other side of the Potomac in Alexandria, taken over other investigations stemming from Wilson's activities, which led eventually to the EATSCO scandal. That investigation involved Wilson cronies Tom Clines, Air Force General Richard Secord, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Eric von Marbod, and the legendary Ted Shackley. Shackley had served in the hottest CIA posts in history. He'd run the Miami station known as JM Wave, targeting Fidel Castro in the early 1960s, and had been a key planner in the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was also directly involved in CIA attempts on Castro's life in concert with the Mafia. In the mid-60s, he'd been the chief of station in Laos, running the largest covert operation in CIA history, a secret war intimately tied with opium and heroin smuggling and the abandonment of large numbers of American POWs. In the late 60s and early 70s, he'd served as chief of station in Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War. After leaving Saigon, Shackley had, for a time, served as chief of the Western Hemisphere Division as the CIA orchestrated the overthrow of Chile's Salvador Allende. He'd then become Associate Deputy Director of Operations, running all covert operations, in time to, as From the Wilderness believes, preside over Ed Wilson's Libyan affairs and the events that would ultimately result in the downfall of the Shah of Iran. Everywhere you looked in Wilson's life, post-1971, you found either Shackley or his career-long deputy and sidekick, Tom Clines. Shackley testified twice before federal grand juries in the Wilson case. In one of those sessions, included in Wilson's recent court findings, he denied anything other than social contacts and a few meetings to evaluate information that had never amounted to much. CIA Inspector General records, some still classified, belied Shackley's testimony. In light of voluminous CIA material, investigative reports, witness statements, BATF interviews with Shackley associates, and a long litany of other records, Ted Shackley's testimony made a lot of people at the CIA and the DOJ very nervous. And From the Wilderness, by the way, found it very interesting to note that in his first testimony, Ted Shackley denied having ever met Ronald Reagan's CIA director, Ronald Casey. That may have to be the subject of another From the Wilderness article. Notes made by Justice Department lawyers in meetings held in late 1983, after Wilson's conviction, indicate their belief that Ted Shackley lied to the grand juries. Unattributed quotes found in meeting notes include the statements, "Stupid, T.S. lied to G.J." The Houston prosecution, for which Greenberg had served as the primary classified record handler, and Assistant U.S. Attorneys Jim Powers and Karen Morissette, had no difficulty establishing that Wilson, in 1976, had secured plans for miniature timing devices for CIA contractors and subsequently had thousands manufactured and shipped to Libya. The Houston prosecution had no difficulty using Barcella's, Bruce's, and Greenberg's investigations to establish that Wilson had conspired to obtain and ship the C-4 in 1977. Greenberg, Barcella, Bruce, Karen Morissette, and local Houston assistant U.S. attorneys also had absolutely no difficulty establishing that Wilson then chartered a DC-8 to ship the C-4 to Libya using falsified records. A hapless lawyer friend of Wilson's California explosives honcho, believing he had clearance from the CIA and other government agencies, even went along on the delivery. He had also been arrested and charged in the case. All of this took place under the guidance of Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard and the supervision of Assistant Attorneys General Stephen Trott and D. Lowell Jensen. Evidence of Wilson's venality was not hard to find and put before the jury. While living in Libya, for extended periods between 1977 and 1981, Wilson hired former Green Berets, some of whom were, according to From the Wilderness sources, alleged to be active-duty troops posing as rogues and retirees out for the money. Using them, he set up an intensive instructional training program for Gaddafi that was intended to make the Libyan colonel a credible terrorist threat and credible foe to any opponent anywhere in the world. That effort was an unqualified success. People and things started blowing up and dying all over the place. All the while, Wilson travelled the globe first class, an ostentatiously wealthy man, owning more than 6,000 acres of prime properties in Virginia, Great Britain, and Malta. Much of that, the prosecution argued, had been paid for with millions from a Libyan dictator who had supposedly dispatched, in 1982, if you believed the press, assassination teams to blow up Ronald Reagan in the White House. Making Ed Wilson out to be a very nasty and unlikable individual was the easy part of the prosecution's case. The second part of the prosecution's case was that one-time career CIA agent Edwin P. Wilson had had absolutely no official relationship with the agency since 1971. Wilson was, they argued, a good guy gone hopelessly bad who had abused his contacts, experience, and the trust placed in him to commit horrible crimes behind the backs of his former colleagues. And that was where both the Department of Justice and the CIA were in deep, deep trouble on February the 2nd, 1983. Wilson, a one-time career CIA agent who had also worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence, was fighting for his life. An open source paper trail from the CIA showed that he had not worked at Langley since 1971. Shortly thereafter, he began working for a secret Navy operation known as Task Force 157. But, according to other records from both the CIA and the Navy, he stopped working for the ONI in 1976, and none of his Navy work was connected to Libya. After that, or so it seemed, even though he continuously socialized with some of the most powerful people in the US intelligence community and the military, he did no official work for anyone. It was in late 1975 and 1976, when George Bush ran the CIA, that Wilson, as an alleged rogue, opened ties to Gaddafi and began selling weapons, explosives, and other services and equipment to the terrorist regime. This would not be the last time that a so-called enemy of the United States in the Arab world would be supplied with weapons and bomb-making materials on a watch under the command of George H.W. Bush. While Ed Wilson was training and equipping Gaddafi, he was also lunching with Bush protege, Shakley. He was providing personal airplanes for Air Force General Richard Secord to fly around in, and loaning large sums of money to Shakley's sidekick, Tom Clines. His company, Consultants International, once a CIA proprietary, which Wilson had bought in 1971, was still receiving referral contracts from the agency. And while former U.S. Army Green Berets in Wilson's employ were teaching Libyans how to blow things up, Clines, a high-ranking active CIA officer, was walking Wilson employee Douglas Schlachter through the halls at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. In 1977, Clines even introduced Schlachter to Jimmy Carter's newly appointed CIA director, Navy Admiral Stansfield Turner. Exclusive parties, horseback riding events, and private hunting parties were held for the A-list at Wilson's expansive Mount Airy farm in Northern Virginia. With the January 1977 change in presidents from Ford to Carter, it was inevitable that George Bush the Elder would have to leave as DCI. Shakley, however, remained in charge of covert operations until December of that year. Then, with a kiss of death, as Wilson's work and life became increasingly high profile, Turner removed Shakley from the prestigious post of Assistant Deputy Director of Operations and transferred him to a non-hands-on post out of the loop. It was the signal that Shakley's career was over. This came at the same time that Turner gave 800 CIA career covert operatives pink slips and early retirement. From the Wilderness believes that it is no coincidence that Barcellas and the BATF investigations of Wilson began at exactly the same time. President Jimmy Carter had already begun the groundbreaking work with Menachem Begin of Israel and Anwar Sadat of Egypt that would lead to the Camp David peace accords. It would not be good PR for the US to be exposed secretly arming Sadat's bitter enemy and next-door neighbor, Muammar Gaddafi, especially since Gaddafi intended to kill Sadat. The problem with the government's position in the Wilson case was absolutely huge. It was almost beyond huge. and the rationale implied during the trial, with the preceding and ensuing vilification of Wilson in major newspapers, People magazine, and best-selling books like Manhunt by Peter Maas, was that the heinousness of his crimes justified obsession and even rule-bending in order to bring the monster to justice. CIA Inspector General investigations, some partially redacted, made available to Wilson's prosecutorial team, dating as far back as 1977, proved that Wilson had provided a number of often embarrassing services for the agency since 1971. These records also showed no less than 80 non-social contacts between Wilson and the CIA between 1971 and 1978. And there's a bit more, but I'm stopping there. Now, that was written in 2000, while Wilson was still in prison. I'm going to jump forward to the following story. This is from 2004, and there's 38 footnotes. I haven't checked it out, but it seems to be fairly solid research. Federal judge tosses conviction of ex-CIA agent framed by the CIA and federal prosecutors. From the Justice Denied magazine, issue 24, page 4. I'm skipping the beginning. Let's hear their summary of the developments after the original trial. After years in prison, Wilson obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act proving his prosecutors knew the Briggs affidavit was false prior to introducing it into evidence. In 1997, Wilson sent U.S. District Court Judge Lynn Hughes a DOJ duty to disclose memorandum he had obtained through the FOIA that said in part, "The affidavit is inaccurate." Judge Hughes subsequently appointed Houston lawyer David Adler to represent Wilson. Adler diligently aided Wilson in the search for additional documents concealed by Wilson's prosecutors. In some cases, Adler had to travel to Washington, D.C. and examine classified documents inside of a vault. Wilson and Adler's investigation resulted in the identification of at least 17 current and former federal officials who concealed their knowledge of the affidavit's falseness. Relying on the new evidence, Wilson filed two motions in the fall of 1999. The first motion was to vacate his conviction. One of the motion's grounds was that the government deliberately used fake evidence, namely the perjured Briggs affidavit that the jury relied on to convict him. Another ground for vacating his conviction was the government committed a Brady violation by failing to disclose exculpatory documents listing Wilson's 100-plus contacts with the government intelligence agencies after he retired from the CIA in 1971. The second motion was to hold the 17 officials who concealed their knowledge of the affidavit's falsity in contempt for interfering in the administration of justice. On October 27, 2003, after spending 4 years sifting through the evidence in Wilson's case, U.S. District Court Judge Lynn Hughes declared, quote, "Because the government knowingly used false evidence against him and suppressed favorable evidence, his conviction will be vacated," unquote. Judge Hughes didn't mince words in a 24-page opinion that outlined the prosecution's failure to turn over the exculpatory documentation of Wilson's many post-retirement CIA contacts that would have proven Briggs' affidavit was perjured. Quote, "It alone lied. It alone possessed and withheld the information that documented the falsehoods. The government alone insisted on the affidavit rather than production of the underlying records. It alone had the underlying documents." Unquote. Judge Hughes also recognized the deliberateness of the decision by federal prosecutors to use the false affidavit. Quote, "The government discussed among dozens of its officials and lawyers whether to correct the testimony. No correction was made. Not after the trial, not before sentencing, not on appeal, and not in this review." Unquote. Judge Hughes made the astute observation that, quote, "the truth comes hard to the government." Unquote. It is so hard that although Wilson had documentary proof in 1997 that CIA officials and federal prosecutors had fabricated Briggs' affidavit to be as favorable as possible to the government, they continued denying, even after Judge Hughes' ruling, that they knew of Wilson's close association with the U.S. intelligence community. That literally continued up to the time of his 1982 arrest and indictment. Judge Hughes has not yet made a decision about Wilson's motion to hold the federal officials who concealed their knowledge that the Briggs affidavit was false. However, Wilson underestimated the number of people involved in the prosecution's scheme to present manufactured evidence against him. While Wilson's motion names 17 people, Judge Hughes has identified about 24 government lawyers who actively participated in the original non-disclosure to the defense, the false rebuttal testimony, and the refusal to correct it. The conspiracy of silence engaged in by every one of these lawyers for over 20 years undercuts the claim of the naive that the federal government cannot engage in large-scale conspiracies. Three of the government lawyers who concealed the truth about the affidavit's falsity while Edward Wilson was wrongly convicted, sentenced, and imprisoned on the 1983 conviction, later became federal judges. And there is more. I shall link to the original from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests/718, but I'm stopping there due to time. Now, for an update, Edwin Wilson was released. He brought a case against those who had, the judge admitted, knowingly introduced false testimony into the court. And how much compensation do you think he got? Well, the answer is no, he didn't get any compensation, because they had immunity. Smacks of royal prerogative, doesn't it? If you lie to court under oath, you might be in serious trouble. But if the number three person in the CIA perjures himself, well, he's a senior chap, so if he perjures himself, then he's got immunity. So is this the Westfall Act? I haven't looked into the details. That's one of the standard get-outs is, oh, well, they were paid by their employer to do this, so therefore you have to sue the employer. And in this case, the employer is the government, so you have sovereign immunity. So this is what I mean by the shallowness of the deep state. This is transparently wrong. Not in a legal sense, because these guys define the legal sense. But as Paul Craig Roberts observed about the US Justice Department, do not expect justice from the Justice Department. I'm reminded slightly of a question John Taylor Gatto quotes when asked, what is an education? One of these people who's a bigwig in the education said, an education is what we dispense, i.e. it is whatever we say it is, and don't bother with any real definitions. So, just as terrorism is what terrorists do, terrorists are people we call terrorists. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see what's going on here. All you have to do is to turn off the commercially controlled media and start thinking for yourself about this. And I think more and more people are doing that. So, just as an aside, I thought, well, I'll put this on WikiSpooks. And I wonder who has been the number three in the CIA, this Inspector General chap. And do you know, I couldn't find a list of all the Inspector Generals of the CIA. They had a list of when people were appointed, but they didn't have when they stepped down. Now, you might think, well, there's always going to be an Inspector General. Ha-ha. Well, I might have thought that, but I've got a page in front of me here talking about the fact that they haven't had Inspectors General. These offices have been empty for months, some cases years on end. The last CIA Inspector General, it tells me, was David Buckley, who left just after it emerged that the CIA had hacked into the computers used by the Senate staffers to investigate the CIA's use of torture. So, as I read that, he didn't want to be holding the can if people are asking serious questions about what's going on here. Perhaps he noticed just how transparently the deep state was overriding official procedures of what was supposed to go on. Now, is this confined to the CIA? No, none of these TLAs, none of these public organizations are actually holding the reins of power. So this is not going to be how it's organized. I got another article in front of me from last month, which says the Justice Department is worried the office of the CIA's top watchdog could be left vacant for a year or possibly longer. Quote, as of today, there are 8 Inspector General positions that remain vacant. As of the end of this month, all of these, except for the CIA Inspector General position, will have been vacant for over a year. Unquote. So this is what I mean by the shallowness of the deep state. You don't need to be an expert researcher to see what's going on. If they can't even find people to fill these supposedly important positions, if you've got an inspector general, it's not a ceremonial position. I imagine somebody with a desk with files going through reports, checking up, seeing that things are done properly. If you've got a job there and nobody is doing this for years on end, they're not even keeping up the facade of an independent apparatus. This is quite clearly an old boys' network, as that judgment about the Briggs affidavit would indicate. You can lie in court under oath. People can go to prison based on your evidence, which turns out not to be evidence at all. And if dozens of lawyers knew that that affidavit was perjured, well, I can't think how many operational guys knew. You know, there must have been all these people at these 100-plus meetings. Then a large number of people knew that that was a lie, and yet nobody said anything publicly. It was only by a chance retrieval of FOIA requests, the fact that that memo to disclose was given out, that this ever became public knowledge. And thinking about why people don't blow the whistle, why they don't try and go public, one might assume that the more people who know about something, the more likely somebody is to spill the beans. And that seems to make intuitive sense. But on the other hand, if you're aware of something and you're aware that thousands of other people also know it and none of them has gone public, that does exert quite a pressure of conformity. One might, particularly if one were dealing with, for example, ruthless, murderous deep state operators, feel more inclined to keep secret the larger the conspiracy. With that reflection in mind, I thought we'd hear the following episode, which I was very impressed with. This is from James Corbett's Corbett Report. This is number 305, published in May 2015. And if you'd like to hear more such, you can do so from CorbettReport.com.
Marks the worst U.S. terrorist attack in history, the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Building in downtown Oklahoma City.
The explosion shook central Oklahoma, killed nearly 170 people and injured more than 400 others.
Someone had detonated a Ryder truck filled with explosives outside the building.
The only suspect actually charged in the bombing so far is Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy
McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh. The Oklahoma City bomber. The face of American terrorism. The face of evil. On the morning of April 19, 1995, the Alfred P. Murrah Building was torn apart by explosions, killing 168. Office workers, passers-by, children in the building's daycare center. Horrified, a nation in grief turned to the authorities for answers. Now, 20 years after that tragic day, we all know the story the public was told.
Less than a week away now from the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, it's still the largest act of domestic terrorism our country has ever seen.
At approximately 8:40 in the morning on April 19, 1995, a slow-moving Ryder truck was seen near the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
A Ryder truck loaded with a diesel fuel and fertilizer bomb blew up next to the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, cutting it in half. 168 people, including 19 children in its daycare center, died.
There you can see as the building was just simply cut away by this huge explosion.
Collapsed into a shifting house of cards. Pulling at the rubble, they sometimes wonder whether they're tugging the piece that holds it all up.
The nationwide search for suspects in the Oklahoma City bombing.
The government has claimed McVeigh was alone. Terry Nichols was later also arrested and convicted as an accomplice.
The plot was said to be an attempt to avenge the deaths of about 80 people in the government siege at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, exactly 2 years earlier.
And that story quickly centered on one man.
Timothy James McVeigh was born April 23, 1968, in Pendleton, New York.
Him in his neighborhood got to be pretty well known for being kind of an attention getter, an outgoing type kid.
For Timothy McVeigh, guns would become a lifelong passion.
McVeigh's decision to join the Army in 1988 comes after high school and a series of dead-end jobs. With his love of guns, this is a natural fit for him.
He and his unit, parts of the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One, were sent to the Gulf and were in place, ready for war, by January 1991. When the war ended, his unit was part of the security force assigned to guard General Norman Schwarzkopf in Saudi Arabia.
McVeigh says several key events caused him to, in his words, snap. Beginning in 1992, when federal agents killed the wife and young child of white supremacist Randy Weaver during a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho.
A call for an imminent war with the government spreads to cell groups across the far right. Timothy McVeigh also becomes convinced by this time. Shortly thereafter, he writes Michael and Lori Fortier, telling them that he wanted to take action against the government. He then enlists the help of his old Army buddy, Terry Nichols. The Regency Tower security cameras photograph McVeigh's Ryder truck passing by on his way to the Murrah Building.
One of the individuals believed to be responsible for Wednesday's terrible attack on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City has been arrested.
A highway patrol officer pulled over Timothy McVeigh less than 2 hours after the bombing for a missing license plate.
In 1997, McVeigh was found guilty on 11 federal counts of murder and conspiracy. He was sentenced to death and executed in 2001.
Timothy McVeigh. We've been told so much about him. What he did. Why he did it. What it meant for America. But how much of it is true? For 20 years, a handful of tireless researchers have been working to expose the lies surrounding the legend of Timothy McVeigh, the lone wolf terrorist mastermind. And what they have uncovered has been remarkable. These researchers are not isolated cranks, but U.S. Air Force weapons experts, Oklahoma State representatives, FBI whistleblowers, government informants, attorneys, eyewitnesses, veteran journalists, and many others whose direct experience contradicts the narrative of the OKC bombing that we have been told. But perhaps the most compelling contradiction of the official story comes from McVeigh himself. According to the official account, McVeigh had set his sights early on in his military career on joining the Special Forces, and it was the frustration of not achieving that goal that caused him to quit the forces suddenly and unexpectedly in 1991.
During his stay at Fort Riley, Kansas, McVeigh had been selected to try out for the Special Forces, the exclusive Green Berets, his dream assignment in the military.
And had trained extensively for it, doing hundreds of push-ups and hundreds of sit-ups every day, carrying 100 pounds of gear 13, 15 miles a day to get himself in the physical condition for the course. The Gulf War changed that for him.
Sergeant Timothy McVeigh was awarded the Bronze Star for Valor and the Combat Infantry Badge for his part in the fighting. When the war ended, his unit was part of the security force assigned to guard General Norman Schwarzkopf in Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, he was told to return to the United States. His long-desired wish to try out for the Special Forces, his revered Green Berets, had finally become a reality.
He was getting everything ready. He was happy. He was excited. He was moving, you know, because he was going to the Special Forces.
1 week later, Sergeant Timothy McVeigh was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, undergoing the strenuous Special Forces tryout. But he was not the soldier he had been before the war in the Gulf.
after living in the desert for 4 months, he was physically drained, particularly the desert conditions. His equipment was wore out.
One of the tests was for him to carry a 45-pound sack with him on a long journey. He was wearing new boots. His ankles were aching. His body and mind were physically out of shape.
His feet were blistered. His ankle was sprained.
At that point, McVeigh knew he could not pass the physically grueling Special Forces tests. It was the most devastating thing that had ever happened to him.
And he sent a written notice to the camp supervisor, a voluntary statement of withdrawal. It reads, "I am not physically ready."
It was his first failure in the military, and his buddies saw an altered McVeigh when he returned from that experience. He was somebody who had succeeded in everything in the military before. Now he had failed, and he seemed somewhat embittered and soured.
But in a letter to his sister in October 1993, published in the New York Times in 1998, McVeigh tells a very different story. Why would Tim, characteristically non-drinker, super successful in the Army, private to sergeant in 2 years, Top Gun, Bronze Star, accepted into Special Forces, all of a sudden come home, party hard, and, just like that, announce he was not only disillusioned by the Special Forces, but was in fact leaving the service? He goes on to answer, "Now here's what led to my current life. It all revolves around my arrival at Fort Bragg for Special Forces. We all took intelligence, psychological, adeptness, and a whole battery of other tests, out of a group of 400. One day in formation, 10 social security numbers were called out, no names, and told to leave formation. Mine was one. The 10 of us were told that out of the select group of 400, we had scored highest on certain tests. We had been selected because of our intelligence, physical makeup, and physical abilities. We were to feel special, part of a hand-picked group. We were all asked to volunteer, talk about peer pressure, to do some work for the government on the domestic as well as international front. What I learned next, both from the briefings and from the questions and private talks, included 1. We would be helping the CIA fly drugs into the U.S. to fund many covert operations, and 2. Military consultants were to work hand-in-hand with civilian police agencies to quiet anyone who was deemed a security risk. We would be government-paid assassins. How did the New York Times address these startling claims in a feature-length article on the letter? A single, parenthetical remark. The government has always denied such activities. This is a remarkable claim, to be sure, but the question should not be whether or not this version of events has always been denied in an unattributed way by an unidentified representative of an unidentified government agency, but whether or not there are facts to back up the claim. So what evidence can we find in the public record that would shed light on the question of whether or not McVeigh was, in fact, still in the military at the time he wrote the letter? And, if such information exists, how does it change the story of the Oklahoma City bombing? Firstly, it makes sense to ask whether or not such a claim is even possible. Does the military engage such task forces of undercover operatives to carry out off-the-record missions? The answer to that question is yes. That answer comes from a number of sources, including Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. As a colonel in the U.S. Air Force and chief of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Prouty worked from 1955 to 1964 as the liaison procuring military supplies, equipment, and logistics support for CIA special operations worldwide. In his 1973 tell-all, The Secret Team, Prouty discussed the inner workings of America's intelligence community, noting, "Sheep-dipped is an intricate Army-devised process by which a man who is in the service as a full-career soldier or officer agrees to go through all the legal and official motions of resigning from the service. Then, rather than actually being released, his records are pulled from the Army personnel files and transferred to a special Army intelligence file. Substitute, but nonetheless real-appearing records are then processed, and the man leaves the service. He is encouraged to write to friends and give a cover reason why he got out. He goes to his bank and charge card services and changes his status to civilian, and does the hundreds of other official and personal things that any man would do if he really had gotten out of the service. Meanwhile, his real Army records are kept in secrecy, but not forgotten." This tactic was used, for example, in Project Heavy Green during the U.S. military participation in Vietnam in the 1960s. Restricted from deploying troops in Laos by the 1962 Geneva Accords, 48 Air Force personnel were instead sheep-dipped and deployed in Laos as civilian employees of Lockheed to service a bombing radar installation there. But was McVeigh sheep-dipped? By its very definition, this process is designed to be hidden from public view. Under such an operation, McVeigh's resignation, paperwork, even his personal life, would all look exactly as it should if he had genuinely been discharged from the military. Even more frustratingly, the sources of information that could potentially prove that McVeigh was in fact sheep-dipped are being deliberately kept from the public. Take the testimony of Terry Nichols. He is serving an unprecedented 161 consecutive life sentences for his part in the bombing at ADX Florence, a supermax prison in Colorado where he shares a cell block with Ramzi Youssef and Ted Kaczynski. In 2007, he provided a sworn deposition to attorney Jesse Trendu, where he stated, "In December of 1992, Timothy McVeigh told me that while he was serving in the U.S. Army, he had been recruited to carry out undercover missions." McVeigh again told the same story to one of his fellow inmates on death row, David Paul Hammer.
McVeigh told me and another inmate here that he was actually an agent working for a guy he called the Major, and he allegedly met this man when he reported to for special trainings duty, and he was told to wash out his special training and asked to accept what was called black ops operations, and he would be working as an independent person, as a part of, and that he would recruit people to be in his unit. According to McVeigh, this association went on for several years, from the end of 1992, and throughout the days of the bombing of the Murrow Building on April 19, 1995.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the federal government has made it as difficult as possible for the general public to access this information or find out more about these claims. After granting the interview discussing McVeigh's military connections, Hammer was placed on lockdown and even prevented from contacting his attorneys. After receiving Nichols' sworn declaration that McVeigh was an undercover Army operative, attorney Jesse Trinity was prevented from gaining access to depose Nichols by a federal judge. The judge in McVeigh's own case also placed sensitive documents obtained by the defense during discovery under seal, documents that the producer of Oklahoma City bombing documentary A Noble Lie claims prove these connections. So perhaps we can start with just laying out the parts of the record that we can all agree on about Timothy McVeigh and his background.
Well, he actually served in the U.S. Army. He was on the security detail for General Schwarzkopf, at the time the Allied Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in the first Persian Gulf War back in 1990. And he was a sharpshooter and a sniper. And he was commended, actually, when he was in custody in the Denver County, or the Denver Federal Courthouse awaiting trial, the Army had to award him two medals of commendation for his stellar service. As far as the special forces, where it's still murky, we weren't able to find any documentation to support the fact that he did work special forces. But we do know that he was an employee by the CIA. He was a drug smuggler and a professional assassin. And this was in the 2.5 years leading up to the devastation of April 19, 1995. We also know that he was on a joint task force with the ATF and the FBI, trying to recruit people to help him blow up federal buildings in seven different cities around the United States.
What you have just said will be stunning to those who have only heard the mainstream narrative of McVeigh. So let's talk about the pieces of evidence that document what you're talking about.
We were able to go through the defense counsel records. Stephen Jones was very generous in giving us access to those records. They're stored at a particular institution on the campus of UT Austin. And through the hard work of Wendy Painting, one of our key researchers, oddly enough, she was born and raised less than an hour from where McVeigh was raised in upstate New York. But she had paid several visits to Austin and was able to access these records. The curator of the institution was very kind to us as a film crew. And I had the honor of actually joining her about that 2.5, 3 months she was down there off and on over the course of 9 months. I joined her for 3 days and saw what she was going through and the records. I mean, this is what the defense counsel, through a discovery process, was able to put together. Unfortunately, the trial only lasted 3.5 weeks, so they weren't able to present a lot of this evidence. And it was by the efforts of Judge Mace, who was the presiding judge. He put a lot of these records under seal, was never allowed to present to the defense or to the jury or the prosecution. The prosecution wasn't even aware of the records. So it was a very stunted and very unfortunate set of events on that short trial.
So what does this evidence amount to? Are these claims true? Until McVeigh's full defense records are unsealed, or witnesses like Nichols and Hammer are deposed and their testimony investigated by a grand jury, researchers will have to rely on evidence in the public record to corroborate these claims and arrive at a better understanding of the bombing and McVeigh's role in it. We do know that in August of 1993, director Bill Bean recorded some footage of Camp Grafton, a National Guard training center that provided explosives and demolitions training, while scouting locations for a film shoot. While filming at Camp Grafton, 1.5 years after McVeigh's supposed discharge from the Army, Bean had an encounter with a man he now firmly believes to have been McVeigh.
So what's your job?
What was that?
What's your job?
I'm all parts clerk.
Oh, you're just parking this one, huh?
Yeah, basically.
Hi, my name is Bill Bean. I work in the film industry. On August 3rd, 1993, I was at Camp Grafton, North Dakota. Camp Grafton is a military training academy for the United States Army, the Army Reserve, and the National Guard. The reason I was there was to scout locations for a film project I was working on. I was given a tour of the base. It's designated by Colonel Dahl. We were by the motor pool, and there were a large group of tanks that were parked there. I saw two soldiers parking an armored vehicle. I asked the billeting director if I could go over and interview the soldiers. So I walked over to the armored vehicle. It had a porthole in the back. I entered inside. The soldier who had been driving the vehicle was closing a hatch in the front. When he turned around, he looked at me and he froze. I had my video camera running and I said to him, "What's your job?" And he looked at me and he said, "What?" I said, "What's your job?" He says, "I'm nobody, I'm just a parts clerk." On August 3rd, 1993 is when I videotaped and interviewed Timothy McVeigh 1.5 years after he was supposedly out of the military completely.
Job?
What was that?
What's your job?
I'm all parts clerk.
You're just parking this one, huh?
Yeah, basically.
Was McVeigh involved in explosives training at Camp Grafton after his supposed discharge? Camp Grafton denies that McVeigh was ever present on base, but beyond the physical resemblance to McVeigh, Professor Michael Blomgren of the University of Utah conducted a voice analysis of the tape and found an 86% match between the person speaking on the tape and audio of McVeigh's interview on 60 Minutes.
I ended up going to Professor Blomgren at the University of Utah, who's in the speech pathology department. He did a voice forensics test. He did various computer and scientific tests on it, and did human voice analysis tests also. His final report to me was that he would testify in a court of law that this is Timothy McVeigh. He had compared it to a 60 Minutes interview and found a near-perfect, near-exact match.
This footage is possible corroboration of McVeigh's story, but it is only that. Possible corroboration. What else can we find on the public record that helps to back up this fantastic tale of McVeigh as a sheep-dipped Special Forces operative? Let's start by examining Nichols' declaration. In it, Nichols, fearing for the safety of his family, notes, "I cannot possibly discuss in this declaration all the information I have concerning the Oklahoma City bombing and others involved, but crucial parts of this terrorist act remain hidden from the American people, especially the identities of the others unknown who collaborated with McVeigh in the bombing." Nichols goes on to reveal the name of one of these collaborators. After noting McVeigh seemed upset and angry in learning about a change in targets for the bombing, Nichols writes that, in what I believe was an accidental slip of the tongue, McVeigh revealed the identity of a high-ranking FBI official who was apparently directing McVeigh in the bomb plot. The name McVeigh let slip was Larry Potts, lead FBI agent at Ruby Ridge. According to Nichols, McVeigh was furious with Potts for changing the script on the bombing and, presumably, targeting the Murrah building. So, who is Larry Potts? Larry Potts was described as the Bureau's fastest-rising star in the early 1990s, and as such was in the center of the Bureau's two most controversial incidents of that time, the Ruby Ridge shootout in which Vicki Weaver and her 14-year-old son were killed by federal agents, and the Waco standoff that ended with federal agents burning down the Branch Davidian compound, killing 76 men, women, and children. In May of 1995, directly after the Oklahoma City bombing, he was promoted to deputy director of the FBI, where he was chief operating officer in charge of hundreds of criminal investigations. He was also the lead investigator on the bombing of the Murrah building. So do we have any evidence that the FBI participated in a cover-up of the OKC investigation? The answer is such a resounding yes that even high-ranking FBI officials have alleged just such a cover-up.
We know there were 24 people that were interviewed by the FBI that said they saw Mr. McVeigh on April 19th with someone else, and they had no reason to make it up. They didn't have a dog in that fight. They didn't have any reason to make something up. They told the agents exactly what they saw, and the agents wrote it down. If only one person had seen it, or two or three, but 24 people say, yes, I saw him with somebody else. That's pretty powerful.
That Danny Coulson, the man in charge of the FBI's collection of evidence from the Oklahoma City bombing, is himself alleging a cover-up, is significant. As Coulson points out, in the immediate wake of the bombing, the largest manhunt in the history of the Bureau was launched to find the two men who were reported as having rented and driven the Ryder truck to its destination. John Doe No. 1 was soon identified as McVeigh, but John Doe No. 2, his accomplice, remained at large.
Who is John Doe No. 2, and where is he? Employees at the truck rental business in Kansas also helped with a sketch of a man who they say was with McVeigh, a square-jawed suspect with a tattoo on his left arm. Authorities made a second, then a third sketch of John Doe 2 with a ball cap, based on a description from an Oklahoma City man who says he gave McVeigh and John Doe 2 directions to Northwest 5th and Harvey, the Murrah building, 30 minutes before the bombing.
So he pulls up and, what, gets out of the truck?
No, he pulls up and I go up to the truck. I went to see what he needed. He said he was kind of lost a little bit, so he was looking for 5th and Harvey, was the words he gave me. He did not distinct a building, the Murrah building or nothing like that. He just asked me where direction of 5th and Harvey was. I kind of tried to explain it to him verbally, and he could seem a little confused by the way I was explaining it to him. So at that time, he got out of the truck, and I kind of walked him about 3 or 4 feet from where we were standing and pointed it out to him, the direction where it was.
Now, all these accounts share a common and unsettling similarity. The witnesses say they saw several accomplices, including the infamous John Doe No. 2. ATF officials tell us the elusive John Doe is still part of this case, but will not comment any further. However, they did tell us that there's a lot about this case we don't know yet, information you can't find in the indictments against Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier.
The first man is of medium build with a light brown crew cut, and he is right-handed.
McVeigh is identified as the mystery man John Doe 1 and arrested.
The second man is also medium build. He's further described as 5 feet 9 inches to 5 feet 10 inches tall, with brown hair and a tattoo visible on his left arm.
What happens next is a conspiracist's dream.
John Doe No. 2 remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous.
But 2 months later, the FBI calls off the search. The official line is, John Doe 2 doesn't exist.
Why was the manhunt called off? Why were 24 separate eyewitnesses along the Ryder truck's route that morning dismissed as having imagined his existence? Is it because even more damning evidence of John Doe No. 2's existence, and more importantly, his identity, was about to emerge?